G'day, I'm Rowan Mackey, and I'm joined by my dad, clinical psychologist Chris Mackey, and this is Psych Spiels and Silver Linings. G'day, Dad. How are you going today?
Good, thanks, Rowan. Good to be with you again.
Always good to be with you on the podcast, and good to be with you after another psychology conference as well. So I think that'll keep us stocked up for topics over the next little while. But before we get to some of those topics, we thought we'd finish off our series on meaning. So obviously, we've covered this in the last couple of episodes, but we've called today's episode The Role of Meaning in Mental Health. And Dad, what are we going to be talking about today?
Okay, well, it seems in recent years there's been an increased emphasis in psychology on life purpose and meaning as an aspect that contributes to well-being. And this particularly comes up in the positive psychology field. And so, being a research-based field, there's actually some research evidence on some of the benefits of having an increased sense of meaning in life. So, certainly what the Greek philosophers talked about when they talked about living a good life and how that overlapped with things like getting a greater sense of meaning. And Viktor Frankl talked explicitly about the relevance of meaning to mental health when he developed the school of logotherapy, as we talked about in a recent podcast. But yes, it's interesting seeing how it's being picked up anew, and particularly in the positive psychology field in the last decade or so.
And it's really interesting as well, because it seems to me that meaning for a long time was de-emphasized in the field of psychology. Like, even as we spoke about Frankl in a couple of podcasts ago now, wasn't it, after having a chat with Ken Harris, he, in his early career, was rejected in some ways by people like Sigmund Freud and Alfred Adler, like these incredibly famous kind of pioneers in the field of psychology. But they de-emphasized meaning as something that was important. And it seems to me through, as you say, positive psychology and other people looking at meaning, it has infiltrated back in a little bit. And so I suppose, yeah, today we'll be looking at some of the ways that it has come back into the field.
Yes, and I suppose it is interesting to see how it maybe went out of the field a bit. And when you think about it, early on, nearly all the schools of psychology around the world were linked to philosophy departments. A lot of how psychology was developed was reflecting on human experience. And so that's where notions of, well, our emotional life and our perspective on things that might include our values and perhaps our deeper way of looking at things, that would have been an emphasis, but maybe somewhat imprecise as far as science goes. So that's where there was a transformation in the early 20th century, with more emphasis on an empirical aspect, a scientific aspect of psychology. And so that particularly developed through behaviorism. But behaviorism was very strong, a scientific method at looking at observed behavior and measuring that quite precisely. And it was an excellent science for looking at our habits, looking at things like classical conditioning and operant conditioning. Still, even these days, it's really informed our understanding of phobias, to some extent depression, anxiety reactions in different areas. But as we can understand, if you're looking at rats running through mazes to understand more about learning and habits, you're not going to be focusing so much on meaning. So it went out of the field. We could say also in the wider field of psychiatry, it was particularly focusing on pathology. So Freud would look at neuroses, anxiety, depression, reactions like that, and looking at ways of alleviating symptoms in certain ways. And it was focusing a lot on the negative side of things. As positive psychology looked to highlight, a whole lot of early clinical psychology and psychiatry was focusing on pathology. Personality difficulties, anxiety, depression, that side of things. And so it really took until positive psychology looking a lot more at the positive pole of well-being that there was a much greater emphasis on meaning that's developing.
And that's interesting as well, because I suppose for a long time, like, I would have understood positive psychology to be about, say, the study of happiness, or like if you look at a lot of Sigmund Freud stuff, like, there can be maybe a slight aspect of it that maybe seems a little bit superficial in some ways. But it is interesting that it is being picked up in terms of meaning being an important part of positive psychology now.
Yes, and look, I might mention as an aside as well, the whole cognitive behavioural field that developed in the 1960s, that had some focus on meaning, but like we've emphasised before, that's more to do with a person's perspective of events, things that happen to them. The notion of it's not what happens to us, but it's how we look at it that counts. So what meaning do we attach to it? But that's where we're looking more at meaning in terms of our perspective or our interpretation or the way we look at things. And cognitive behavioral therapy looked to help us alter how we perceive things or what meaning we attach to them in terms of not overgeneralizing about negative things that happen or not having other distorted beliefs like an extra focus on the negatives than the positives, other ways of looking at distortions in our thinking. But cognitive behavioral therapy wasn't so much looking at the positive pole of meaning, perhaps until ACT came along. Acceptance and commitment therapy would look more at people's values. That gets more at meaning in that way. But largely CBT was about alleviating anxiety, depression, other kind of personality difficulties, and focusing on negative thoughts and countering them rather than so much emphasis on positive meaning. That maybe came a bit more later into CBT, but I think it's the field of positive psychology that's been the most explicit on exploring the positive well-being impacts of meaning.
Well, it's interesting that it did, say, go out of the field of psychology for a little while, because there's a fella, Michael Steger, who we'll be talking about a little bit today, and we've done a bit of research on his stuff. He's someone who's well, very inculcated, I suppose, in the field of meaning and the study of meaning. And he had this really interesting analogy that I heard, where he's basically talking about life in terms of, say, being in the ocean, and there's all these waves that can kind of come and crash down upon you, and you know, you can basically deal with a lot of these waves, and you know, you go for a bit of a surf, all this sort of stuff. But it's almost like every so often you're going to get that tsunami that you can't necessarily prepare for, like that rogue wave that just comes in and sort of knocks you around. And in some ways, that's a little bit what life's about. And I think if we look at, for example, just alleviating symptoms, well, it's almost like we've got a reactive approach to when that happens. But it just strikes me that looking at things like meaning and purpose and all these kind of deep questions, in some ways they allow us to put a bit of, say, infrastructure around our thinking to almost mitigate against, well, the potential damage that these kind of life crises can cause. Like if we have a bit of an understanding of meaning and purpose and these ideas, it can just really help to, when something does happen and knock us around a bit and potentially move us in a slightly different direction, well, we can kind of go back to what we know is inside us and you know, at least have some sense of what kind of the course would have been without such a disruption. And that can help us, I suppose, to reorient back towards where we would have been heading in the first place. And I suppose that analogy just really resonates with me in terms of the importance of meaning in some ways, because that just really makes a lot of sense.
Yes, and that analogy again relates a lot to what Viktor Frankl talked about. When he talked about meaning, one of the main components he talked about was finding courage in the face of adversity. And so naturally he would have an emphasis on that, having been interned in prison camps during the Holocaust. He lost family members through the Holocaust. He faced adversity in about the most extreme way that you could imagine. And so that was one of the components about it. But what you're describing there with that analogy as well, potentially being knocked around by the waves, yes, a whole lot of looking to develop our sense of life, purpose and meaning is strengthening ourselves on the inside. Because the stronger we are on the inside, the more we can withstand the challenges on the outside. So that's a whole lot of what developing resilience is on about. And there's a lot of emphasis on developing resilience, say, even in school well-being programs these days. Part of the challenge might be, maybe it's difficult to develop resilience so fully just by learning about it and thinking of what strategies generally might help. Maybe we actually need to go through a number of significant challenges in life to more fully develop our resilience. So that's one of the challenges of developing a further sense of meaning. Maybe there does need to be a degree of stress and challenge in life as a necessary component of developing more this capacity to strengthen ourselves from within.
Well, it's a really interesting idea, because I suppose, like, if you think about, for example, maybe the interpretation in popular culture in some ways, like, you know, if you were to ask, say, for example, a parent, you know, what do you want for your kids? Well, I believe most parents would sort of say, oh, you know, I just want them to be happy. Or, you know, you can have this notion about even friends or relationships or whatever it is, like, I just want them to be happy. But when you kind of say it in those terms, and I think it's true, there's really something in it that, well, if we're just happy all the time, there's a whole maybe element of life that, you know, we can get a lot out of. Like, you think of things like post-traumatic growth and all these ideas. Like, if we're just looking at happiness almost as the, well, kind of mediator for a good life in some ways, well, potentially we're left, you know, without access to a whole lot of kind of the richness of life that potentially even adversity and going through challenges and things like this can provide.
Yes, and when you think about it as well, the goal of being happy, what does it actually mean? Because if we consider it to include often being in a happy mood, well, happy feelings like a positive affect or a positive mood is basically going to be somewhat fleeting and temporary. Generally, painful and negative moods, the same. Like our feelings are going to go up and down. We're not going to be everlastingly happy, and there'd be something quite bland about that. And so early on in positive psychology, that was also recognised and highlighted, for example, by Ray Baumeister, who would contrast happiness and meaning. And he'd say happiness would not last as long, the benefits of that, in a sense, looking to boost happiness as boosting meaning, because to boost our happiness or look at our happiness, we could be thinking of that as basically satisfying our needs and wants in the present. Present moment, yes, I've got what I want now, I'm feeling happy enough. But that's not necessarily so lasting or deeply satisfying or impactful in our life as some of the other elements that Baumeister said. This is more meaning, this is where it differs from happiness. It's also a strong emphasis on what you give to others. And any spiritual tradition or, again, ancient Greek philosophy, they'd look at what was called eudaimonic well-being, which means, you know, looking to give a good life, including what you look to give to other people. Then there's another element of self-expression, which also Viktor Frankl highlighted. He talked about purposeful work or creativity. So creativity as being an element of meaning. And then there's also the other aspect of how you deal with stress and pressures. So interestingly, the three dimensions that Baumeister highlighted, the differentiated meaning from happiness, are similar to what Viktor Frankl highlighted as helping meaning. So on the one level, where Frankl talked about purposeful work or creativity, Baumeister partly described by talking about self-expression and also what you give others. Frankl highlighted love, and that connection with others also comes up with Baumeister. And then finding courage in the face of adversity, as Frankl put it, well, that overlaps with how we deal with stresses. So there are those different elements that come up when people think in terms of meaning, different components of it. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later in relation to Michael Steger's work.
Well, it's interesting because I suppose, you know, there's that cliche, for example, of like, oh, you know, people on their deathbed sort of, you know, never say this or never say that, or, never say I should have worked more or things like this. And I suppose another one that you seem to get a sense of is they never say that I wish I was happier for longer. They always, you know, these kind of deathbed sentiments quite often relate to meaning in some ways. And it just strikes me as interesting that, you know, when it all comes to the crunch and, you know, we're sitting there kind of at the end of life reflecting on things, it's the things that are most meaningful which stand out to us as kind of being the most important in some ways.
Well, that's also very relevant to therapy, what you just described then. What you often see in terms of people getting a greater sense of meaning from their everyday life, you often see that from people coming through crises. Because it's going through a crisis, and that can include people experiencing post-traumatic stress following a workplace injury or a car accident, or after a significant loss. There are times which really concentrate people's minds on what counts the most. It could be through being made redundant at work. For many of us, we would have reflected on things further about what's important in our lives following the pandemic, when our lives were turned upside down for a period of time. And that probably comes across in that phrase, crisis equals opportunity, where there's a Chinese symbol for crisis, which is basically equivalent to the symbol for opportunity, linking those two themes together. Or we look at the Greek word for crisis, also meaning to sift. And what are we sifting? We're looking at what's most important in life, what's most important to us. So yes, often when people present in a therapy situation, and it might be going through what we could call a midlife crisis, we'll talk about that later, different challenges that people face, there's also something of a promise. Because when people go through really challenging times where they feel their life is coming apart in some way, the coming apart is actually an opportunity to step back and reflect and look at how you might want to put things back together, perhaps in a slightly different way to before. And that's a lot to do with meaning, not always so much to do with happiness at the time, because people aren't usually feeling that good through much of that process. Maybe the good feelings come later when people are applying and then consolidating the changes of what they believe might be more worthwhile or meaningful or valuable to them.
Well, it's interesting. Like, I'll ask you a little bit more about therapy in just a second. But like, one thing I really wonder there is, we've spoken a little bit about on the podcast before, and I think we did, you know, just about a whole episode on it in some ways, about the idea that when someone comes in to see you for therapy, the first thing that you ask them is, you know, what do you hope to gain from seeing me? Like, it strikes me that when people would maybe finish therapy, a lot would have a clear insight of what they've gained in terms of meaning in their life. But I wonder to what degree people, for example, have been through a crisis and what do you hope to gain from seeing me? Well, I hope to feel better. Like, how often does, say, hoping to feel better and almost that kind of symptom alleviation come up from the perspective of a client of like what they want to get out of therapy versus I want to gain more meaning from this experience that I've been through? Like, do people often have that insight when they're coming into therapy? They might, you know, the symptoms that they're experiencing might be quite uncomfortable at the time, but to what aspect do people almost say yearn for that kind of meaning and understanding right from the time that they're in a crisis?
That usually does not come up explicitly at all. Usually, initially, people are looking for some alleviation of distress. And so they'll often spill out the kind of distress that they're having. It might be in a relationship or a work situation, or the feelings that they're having, like the depression or anxiety that they're experiencing. It might be in a specific situation or two, or it might be in a wider range of situations. But people are usually looking for some easing of distress. Sometimes it comes up indirectly, the meaning angle, if people say that they're struggling to get a sense of direction. And so that's when they're looking for a little bit more life purpose. People often don't put it that way either. They often highlight the distress. But there are times underneath it all, there's this sense of an ongoing malaise that people have felt, where there's been maybe less energy, less sense of direction. They don't feel their usual self in some kind of way. So they're yearning for a deeper connection with themselves and more direction in life that gets at meaning in some ways, but often not spelled out that way. And it's usually only later stages of therapy, I find, more in retrospect, where people are highlighting the sense of greater meaning or understanding that they have.
Well, I wonder then, so for example, like, what situations would come up in therapy where it's a little bit more important to be explicit about meaning? And how do you introduce that in some ways? Because it is the sort of thing, like, as we speak about it, like, there is this kind of notion that, you know, you'd go see a therapist and, you know, what do you want to gain from me? You know, I want to feel better in my situation. And like, that implies that there's kind of some point where you've kind of got to, you know, broach the kind of elephant in the room in some ways. And that might not necessarily always be comfortable with people, because like, these are kind of deep, dark questions and very personal, very individual questions for people as well. So I wonder, yeah, like, when often does that come up in therapy, and are there maybe more situations where it comes up than others?
Okay, where it most explicitly comes up is when someone's going through what we might call a midlife crisis, around 40 years of age, give or take 2 or 3 years, or a late midlife crisis where similar issues might come up, especially if they haven't been so fully dealt with around that 40-year mark. And so this tends to be around people being around 51, 52, the early 50s, for different kind of reasons that comes up then. It might be through greater awareness of mortality, because maybe a parent has died, children might be growing up and leaving home, the person might have faced some significant medical problem for the first time, people might be starting to wonder about what their retirement might look like. And those things can lead people to feel more uncertain about the direction they're going in, or there's something in their life that's not working so well for them. And under those circumstances, people might have more of a sense that they're confused. They're confused about their life direction. And they might just feel like there's a question in their life and their life being worthwhile. And certainly when people are experiencing prolonged suicidal thoughts, and that might be associated with some kind of loss, but also upheaval in someone's life in a particular way. And different life transitions. That can include for adolescents and young adults trying to figure out what kind of future's worthwhile for themselves. So this is where it might come up more directly, but it can come up also sort of more indirectly in some ways after trauma, especially after people have experienced the traumatic loss of a family member. And that could be through a criminal attack, or it could be a natural disaster or some other kind of situation where the person, through going through that extremely painful loss, can, having also lost that sense of connection to someone close, but people can be really thrown back on the sense of, well, why, how might this happen? Then a couple of other examples where it will come up directly or indirectly, certainly with depression, where people tend to lose their sense of purpose in their life and have lower levels of energy, and it's harder for them to organise their life in certain kind of ways and get a sense of what their life is on about, and find it hard to have the motivation maybe to keep going even on a day-by-day basis. And then even to some extent with burnout issues, where people feel so worn out or exhausted in their work, they're not getting the enjoyment or satisfaction from life so much. And that can lead people to question over a period of time, especially if it tips over into depression, whether what they're doing is worthwhile. Are they living the right kind of way? Is this going to go on forever? Have they just lost touch with themselves? So there's some of the range of situations where it might come up.
And it's the sort of thing as well, like Michael Steger talks about this too, where he talks about, for example, the not just the mental health benefits of finding meaning, like the physical health benefits of finding meaning as well. Like, it strikes me that this is quite a contribution that modern psychology has made as well, in terms of, for example, researching some of the benefits of meaning. And yeah, what are some of those benefits that they talk about of meaning?
Okay, well, this is a particular contribution of a scientific approach. So where people previously might have emphasized, well, it helps to have a greater sense of life purpose and meaning, and we think, yes, well, that's a good thing, but to know it has these kind of benefits. Certainly, when people have a greater sense of meaning, it can alleviate their depression and anxiety symptoms to a degree. Certainly, when people have a greater sense of meaning rather than a lesser sense of meaning, then naturally that has benefits in reducing suicidal thoughts and substance abuse. And apart from alleviating these kinds of distress like depression, anxiety, certainly when people have a greater sense of meaning, it enhances a lot of positive things. So people get a greater sense of positive affect or happiness, life satisfaction, more enjoyment from work, engage in more caring relationships, they have more optimism, high level of self-esteem, higher satisfaction with life. But this is a striking thing. When people have a greater sense of meaning, they also tend to have better sleep, better immune function, and even better longevity. They live longer. So there's a lot of really solid reasons backed up by research for how it's worthwhile to have a greater sense of life purpose and meaning.
And that longevity aspect is a really interesting one. Like, Michael Steger highlighted a study that was done in England. I believe it was called the English Longitudinal Study of Aging. So a bit of a mouthful. But I believe in this research, like, they specifically address the question, what advantage might having a strong sense of meaning in life afford a few years down the road? And they surveyed people a couple of years apart, and things came up like, you know, lower risk of divorce, lower risk of living alone, increased connections with friends and engagement in social and cultural activities, lower incidence of new chronic disease and onset of depression, lower obesity and increased physical activity. Like, these are core aspects to what we would consider a fulfilled life in some ways. And it just strikes me that looking at this particular study, which, as I say, like highlighted by Michael Steger, who's really looked into this sort of stuff, like it just seems like such a kind of core part of, well, certainly later life towards, you know, getting to even, you know, the elderly stages of life. But for anyone, like we can all cultivate more of a sense of meaning, which is, well, gonna, according to this research, set us up a lot better for the later stages of life and I suppose progressing through life as well.
Yes, a very interesting one, that English study, and it looks like there's a two-way relationship also between, say, meaning and increased connections. Because that study, as you described, highlighted that when people had a higher sense of meaning, they had better developed social relationships. But it reminds me also of the longitudinal Harvard study in America over about five decades, where they found that one of the key factors that help people's, again, their longevity, as well as their physical and mental health, was their quality of connection with other people. And so Christopher Peterson highlighted that from the start in the positive psychology field with the mantra, other people matter. So it just shows again, right from the start of the field of positive psychology, not just focused on positive affect, but also look at other things which are associated with meaning, like the quality of people's connections with others, or simply, as Viktor Frankl put it, love, loving connection with other people. So there's a two-way relationship that way. People have more positive relationships with others. That's an aspect of meaning, but people have a greater sense of meaning in their life. That also facilitates better quality of relationships.
And I suppose the mental health benefits in some way, like sort of speak for themselves a little bit. But as someone who's not really trained in this area, like it's the physical health benefits that to me are just amazing. Like it's so kind of unintuitive the way that we've thought about sort of, you know, medicine and the kind of way that we are for such a long time, that there would be so many physical health benefits to meaning as well as the mental health benefits. And the other thing that really stands out for me there is that we've had more of a sense in the last few years that people are going to go through different crises in their life. And there's maybe a movement in psychology in some ways not to just medicate everyone who's, you know, in the real kind of dark night of the soul, to borrow terminology from our other episodes. But I suppose looking at, for example, meaning and the benefit that we can gain from going through dark times and like all this sort of stuff, like what that would do to destigmatize someone who is in a situation where, you know, they're really dealing with some mental health challenges, like that would just be massive. So it seems to me that this has been a big part of the evolution of psychology in many ways, and it's leading to just a whole range of benefits individually, but also about things like the stigma around mental health too.
Yes, and I think that's a problem of so much mental health research being promoted, quite frankly, by drug companies, and such a prevailing influence of the medical model and psychiatry, this notion of, oh, we need to look to alleviate symptoms by using this external agent, medication, that people might need to take for the rest of their life. Sure, there are a number of circumstances where medication can have profound benefits, where people are dealing with psychosis, bipolar disorder, say intractable depression, which hasn't responded to other kind of treatments. There are a whole range of situations where medication can be absolutely crucial in people's recovery. But there are a very large number of situations where that's not the case. Like our practice research as well, it shows that when people suffer from major depressive disorder, the 200 people that we'd treated without medication had recovered just as well as the 400 people who had been on medication through their treatment, and in the same number of sessions and a similar severity of symptoms. So the recovery in general in psychological therapy when people were not on medication was just as good. Well, what are we working on with psychological therapy? Basically, we are looking underneath it all at there being some meaning to people's symptomatic distress. Sometimes it might be understandable in terms of there having been excessive stresses. So it might have been a challenge or a loss where it makes sense that the person's suffering to a degree. If it's excessive stresses that are external, like dealing with burnout situations, can we reduce the workload or adjust someone's priorities? Maybe look to be a bit less perfectionistic and allowing oneself a little bit more room to struggle through without maybe being down on yourself so much. If it's after loss, a traumatic loss, people don't necessarily have to be diagnosed with having a major depressive disorder, as DSM-5 would suggest. We can look at it as normal grief often. Even if people have lost their appetite or they're tired or they're not sleeping as well, that's part of a normal part of recovery. And difficulty with concentration and lower mood, that's natural. If someone's, for example, lost their life partner of many years, that needn't be just diagnosed as depression in my view. So we can look at circumstances of loss and also look at natural processes of grief that come through. But even with significant trauma reactions where people are also depressed, we know that a lot of therapy techniques, including EMDR, other kind of exposure therapies for trauma, different ways of people trying to gain some sense of meaning in the long run through their experience, but allowing for the fact that their world has been turned upside down and disrupted. And many people will recover well through that. Actually, many people will recover even without therapy. And 2/3 of people who go through a significant crisis will not necessarily develop a post-traumatic stress disorder, even if it's a real challenge. But when we have the view that there's potentially some meaning that will come out of the process of people going through a difficult time, including a depression. Like when I went through 2 depressions, the second for which I was hospitalised, I basically had to work through a whole lot of things, including perfectionism, had to have a double go at working through that, but also other kind of things I was dealing with, looking at what settings it's best to work in, looking at ways of dealing with certain conflict situations, had to adjust a number of those things. And they were life lessons supported by going through an experience of depression when it just became very clear to me that some things weren't working, including in that situation, my particular workplace. I needed to leave. So there are a range of ways that we can learn from that past experience, and our most recent episode on Second Chances with Ken Harris, the lead author of that book, was documenting many people's stories of going through crisis situations and the gains that could come through that. That's basically stories of recovery and renewed sense of meaning and purpose in life. Often people come through a challenge. When they recover, it's not just that they're no longer depressed or anxious, certainly to the extent that they were before, but usually people come through that with something added. Greater self-acceptance, greater empathy for other people going through challenges, and a refined sense of priorities of what's important and what's not.
And I think Ken's such a, I suppose, good example of like if we kind of go a bit broadly with it, like the benefits of meaning in many ways is what we're talking about here. Like Ken's such a good example for that because he just exudes kind of enthusiasm for life in a way that just gives you such a sense that he's internalized a lot of this stuff. And he's internalized, I suppose, a process of looking at the world and going about his, you know, his life in a way that, you know, in some ways you feel like, you know, water wouldn't bounce off him in terms of, you know, I'm sure he's got challenges as everyone does, but he just has such an exuberance about the way that he expresses himself that he, you know, in many ways encapsulates that idea of, well, what are the benefits of meaning? Well, go see Ken and you'll get a real sense of how that comes across.
Yes, I certainly like his way with connecting with people that otherwise we'd think of as being strangers, but Ken seems to think of them, these people he's encountered, for example, on the beach in Florida or wherever, a number of whom ended up as authors in his book. But basically, Ken seems to view other people that he encounters as friends that he just hasn't met yet, rather than just seeing them as distant strangers.
Well, absolutely. And as we say, like Ken really encapsulates that idea of, you know, the benefits of having a real sense of meaning and understanding and thinking a bit more about this sort of stuff. And that seems to be one of the real benefits of modern psychology and how meaning has been reintegrated in many ways through the field of positive psychology. It strikes me that another aspect of modern psychology and what it can give us for meaning is maybe give us a bit more of a sense of what meaning is in some ways. Like, it's a bit of a cliche, like if you were to, you know, say to someone or you see it in movies and stuff, like what's, you know, the deepest kind of, you know, not necessarily darkest, but what's the deepest question in life? And, you know, it's this idea of, you know, what's the meaning of life? Like it's almost become a meme or a bit of a cliche in some ways. And I think about that book, is it Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, where it comes up about, you know, what is the meaning of life? And, you know, it basically says 42. And it's making a joke out of trivializing this idea that, you know, the meaning of life is just this kind of such deep philosophical question that everyone has and everyone kind of interacts with it in a way. But Viktor Frankl is one person, I think, who can sort of point us in a bit more of a direction of what meaning is in a psychological context. But how else does meaning come up in psychology, maybe in terms of how we can understand it a little bit more?
Okay, look, I think in a way, one of the simplest ways of getting at it, and this is where meaning and purpose overlap, but they're not just the same thing as we'll describe shortly. But one of the things is considering, certainly in adult life, what is your big why? What's your big motivation for getting up in the morning? What is most important to you, or we could say your big why? I think Martin Seligman tended to operationalize that in terms of looking at identifying your top character strengths, something we highlight on this podcast, assessing your character strengths, but looking to use your top character strengths in the service of other people. So that's got the purposeful work, the self-expression and creativity, the considering other people. It's got those elements of meaning, but using your top strengths and personality characteristics in the service of other people. That's a way of looking at it. And one other thing I'll mention that I found very helpful for looking at your big why, this comes up maybe more in a work setting. I learned it in like an entrepreneurial course or program. They encourage people to come up with a creative direction in their work. And they basically summed it up as, look at two important areas that intersect in your life. And they would have used an example of two areas intersecting with Steve Jobs. So the Apple founder, I believe it was liberal arts and technology. With Richard Branson, so he's associated with the Virgin Companies, was the notion of disrupting companies and fun. You get a sense of his personality and where that would have fitted in. I found that very helpful to reflect on and think, okay, well, what are a couple of things that are particularly important to me? This is more maybe in a work life, but one thing I knew is mental health and secondly, transformation. So looking at transformative ways of helping people improve their mental health, and that's where, to me, the different, what we could call psychotechnologies like EMDR can come in, or chair work, or even looking at synchronicity and how that can lead to an epiphany in someone's life that gives them a greater sense of meaning from this meaningful coincidence that's happened in their life. So I found that helpful in my work and knowing it's not so much other areas of health or organisational change or other areas of psychology maybe to focus on, and also not just to look at methods in psychology that lead to incremental change, look at something beyond that. And even looking at the research on methods that can help people achieve more significant or profound change than just incremental change. So that's a personal example, but other people might think of their own examples or just be open to the notion of reflecting on what might be your big why, what's something that really motivates or moves you in everyday life. And also, can you consider maybe a couple of different elements or components of what might be part of what most moves you, including in a work situation?
Well, it's interesting. Like, it's a very interesting idea, this idea of your big why. Like, it strikes me in some ways, it's almost an updated way of asking, you know, what is the meaning of life in some ways? Like, it's still, in many ways, getting at that kind of question, and it does distill things a little bit more, I suppose. But I think you're even mentioning to me off air that term meaning of life, like, that was only coined in, what was it, 1834, or like, this is a relatively recent, I suppose, way of looking at things that potentially sort of modern entrepreneurship felt needed an update in many ways. But I'll even just mention in terms of, I suppose, like, my own personal experience with that kind of intersection question of looking at the two things. Like, we've spoken about that for, what, 10, 15 years, and I must admit, I quite struggle with that, with the idea of kind of finding two things. And I think that speaks to maybe the complexity of the question in itself. Like, these are not necessarily easy things to answer. And that's where I think, once we look into these things, get a bit more of an understanding from, you know, as many areas as we can, and modern psychology is obviously a big one of that, it helps us to maybe granularize things a little bit more, or think about things in a slightly more simple way that can help us to have more of a sense of that sort of stuff. And I know Michael Steger talks a lot about this, obviously his whole kind of thing in many ways, but he talks about, say, what is meaning, or the different elements of meaning. And yeah, I wonder if you could just give us a sense of what those are.
Yes, I will describe how Michael Steger breaks down meaning into three different components. But first, I'd like to highlight what you just said. I really agree with that, about this being far more complex than it looks. When I described that the two main areas intersecting for me, for my big why, were, say, mental health and transformation, that took me at least 3 to 4 months to figure that out at the start of a process of writing a book. And so being guided by what was my ultimate purpose or interest in writing a book. At first I thought of things like, well, clinical psychology and change, or therapy and psychology, or like, there are lots of things that can seem similar, but it doesn't quite encapsulate it. But what does help when you do get more of that idea of a couple of areas that intersect is when things lie outside of those areas. So if it's other forms of health, but not so much mental health, or again, in my case, it's incremental change, or just doing things the same way rather than something more transformative, which to me is more creative, then if it didn't involve those elements, then I knew to be less interested. Whereas if something did combine those two elements, I'd be much more interested in focusing on that, which is partly where my interest is in, like, synchronicity and meaningful coincidence, and how that can lead to epiphanies in therapy that has that element of those two elements to it. So I spend more time and effort in that kind of area. That's just a personal example. But yes, getting back to Michael Steger's work on meaning, and he emphasised that rather than looking at it as one global thing, it's not just purpose. That's a part of it, but three different areas. One is a sense of coherence. So that's making sense of one's life. Basically, it goes together in a certain way. We have an overall understanding of it. So if people are going through a midlife crisis, they might have lost that sense of a coherent narrative in life of who am I, what am I on about, those core questions. Then there's certainly the sense of purpose, so core goals in your everyday life. It's more in relation to purpose. We might look at that intersection of two things that guide us. And then there's significance. So that's the notion of your life having some inherent value and having a life worth living. In other words, that's about mattering. And I suppose, as Chris Peterson said, about other people matter. That's part of the significance aspect. So that doesn't depend on people achieving in any particular way. They don't need to run through hoops, or they don't need to have some kind of marker of their great ability, just simply from being themselves. That's enough for the person to matter and be significant. That's another component of meaning.
And you mentioned as well that there are maybe situations, or maybe mental health challenges that people could go through, where these, I suppose, different elements of meaning almost show up in different ratios, for lack of a better term. Like, different elements might be more pertinent to different people in different situations. Could you just speak to that a little bit as well?
Yes, well, sometimes it can seem, when you divide up the notion of meaning into these three different elements, is it kind of like splitting things up too much, or is it maybe an academic take on a situation and maybe more analysis perhaps than we might need to do? Well, actually, when you look at those three different elements, they do show up in different ways in therapy. So first of all, coherence. Sense of comprehensibility in one's life making sense. You really notice that being challenged when people are going through a midlife or late midlife crisis. So again, there's that sense of who am I, what am I on about, what has led up to this time now, what might I do in future, a whole lot of confusion around those things. And basically, when people are facing that kind of challenge, it's often important to be patient and to sift, like that Greek word for crisis also being the word to sift, to take time and let different kind of thoughts and reflections bubble up over time. You don't try and quickly get a sense of coherence in your life. It's over a period of time the jigsaw puzzle pieces might fall into place again, maybe in a different way to what you anticipated. Another time is after significant trauma, such as I mentioned, if someone had a traumatic loss. Basically, a family member might have been killed in a car accident. Like one lady I know, her mother sadly died in a car accident. She was at a railway station, rang up her mum, asked for a lift. As the mum is driving through an intersection, a truck goes through a red light and takes her out. The mother's killed. Not only does the daughter go through a real sense of grief and loss, but also the notion of how could that be? If it was just 1 second either way, if I didn't ring up my mother from the train station, why this, why that? Often people are asking the question, why after a trauma loss? Why did this happen to me? How could that happen to me? Now, sometimes that's not going to come quickly. Sometimes people need to go through a fair bit of grief and processing before they're even ready to review that kind of notion. And ultimately, it might be an unanswerable question. There might be challenges of chance or fate where certain things happen in a certain kind of way, but people can then come to build their life again and make sense of their life in a new way. So after loss or trauma, no doubt that would be part of people going through experiences of being, say, a refugee coming from a war zone, having to relocate and making a life elsewhere. One of the challenges would be, again, getting a sense of order and comprehensibility in one's life. So that would be the coherence side. Then with purpose, having a sense of core goals, aims and direction in life. Well, that goes with depression, like that's lost often with depression. People lose their sense of purpose. And we see this come up a couple of ways in therapy as well. Just simply being depressed when people are focusing on the negative, they're feeling negative about themselves and things that happen in the future, and it might be quite distorted ideas. And sometimes that might even be influenced by excessive stresses. Now, there are times where we help people deal with that. They deal with the excessive stresses. They maybe change their perspective in some ways. They become more optimistic in their thinking and maybe looking at things in a clearer way. And generally in that situation, people's satisfaction with life will improve. Not only their anxiety and depression symptoms come down, but their satisfaction with life goes up. But there's some people who might deal with the excess stresses. Their depression and anxiety comes down, but they still have a fairly low satisfaction with life. What generally means, because we measure that for each person that we see in therapy, is gauging the progress in therapy, looking at satisfaction with life as well as symptoms. What that usually means is that there's a problem in the structure of the person's life in some way. A primary relationship or their work life or their social life or different aspects of where they're living, there's something structural that's missing out, and often people might need to make more changes or deeper changes than maybe reducing their stresses and shifting their thinking. So that's an example where people's sense of purpose might be challenged and they might need to renew a sense of purpose. But sometimes people's sense of purpose can be reduced just by depression itself. And at times that can be following a loss or following excess stresses where it's more understandable and where it's more temporary. And then there's the significance component of meaning. That's where people have a sense of their life having an inherent value and feeling their life is worth living. That is most challenged where people have childhood experience of abuse and neglect. Especially repeated experience of abuse and neglect. Many people we see with dissociative disorders, with what might be called complex post-traumatic stress disorder, especially if people had very complicated relationships with a parent. A parent might have been abusive, neglectful in certain kind of ways. A parent might have been so focused on their own needs, not really considering so much the needs of their children in raising them. And that's where people might be more questioning their worth or their value. So part of schema therapy is about people going back to identify different kind of perspectives or beliefs that could be influenced by that life experience, such as I can't count on other people, or I'm not so worthwhile, or I'll be abandoned in future relationships, or I can't expect to get my needs met. And that can be a longer therapy process as well to develop that sense of significance. But more temporarily, that will be challenged when people are experiencing depression, often just after trauma reactions. But helping separate out these things of coherence, purpose, and significance, basically, each of those are important to therapy. At first, we hopefully help people develop further their sense of significance by the therapy relationship itself, feeling that they matter to the therapist, the quality of the relationship, someone can care for them, be interested in them in that situation. Then, as people are going through therapy, from reflecting on things that are happening and have happened, looking to make further sense of that, that's looking to get a greater sense of coherence. As people maybe get a greater sense of themselves and more understanding of what's happened, that can help then in a future sense developing further one's sense of purpose. Then the importance is acting on that. Meaning is a lot about action. Meaning in life is often about refining your sense of priorities and then acting on that. And that's where, in the long run, the behavioural aspects of psychology come back into the picture. Our habits, our actions, our daily actions, our routines in everyday life, very important to consider. But we can have them based on a sense of meaning and direction in life that will enhance our physical as well as our mental health.
Well, it's really interesting the way that you described that, because, like, I must admit, and I suppose particularly maybe before we had a bit of a chat about this off air, like I was looking at some of this sort of stuff and thinking, you know, is it a little bit too reductionistic to look at things in such a granulated way? Like, does it take some of almost the magic of meaning and looking into meaning, just take some of that out of things when you really distill things down to such a degree? But I think the way that you described that there, and maybe how different aspects of meaning relate to different challenges and different things that can come up through life, like, that gives us a real sense of maybe the extra control that we can get through looking at these things in more than just a single concept of meaning. For example, like if we break things down, then we can go, all right, well, is it my coherence or significance that, you know, I may be struggling with a little bit? And I suppose in some ways to bring those aspects back together, like, to me, they all relate to obviously meaning, but life narratives as well seems to be a big part of it. Like, the stories that we tell ourselves about, you know, where we've been, where we're going, who we are in the world, like all these kind of deep questions in many ways relate to a life narrative. And if we're thinking about our own life narrative, well, we want it to be coherent. You know, you want it to be something that kind of makes sense to you, because you don't want to just, you know, be jumping here or there and have no sense of how, I suppose, the aspects of your life kind of form together. Like, I remember something that your grandmother said when she was in her later life, of, you know, the older you get, the more you get a sense of the puzzle pieces falling into place. And so, you know, you want your life narrative to have a sense that, you know, even if it's not perfectly formed, like, you know, 30 years old, like, I feel like just such a rookie in life still in many ways, but you get more of a sense, I suppose, as you get older, of how the different puzzle pieces can kind of fall into place for you, and that relates to coherence in some ways. And then, of course, you know, you want, I suppose, a purpose to be the kind of direction of your life narrative, and obviously we can look back into the past, but you want to know, you know, or maybe don't even necessarily want to know, but you want to have some idea of kind of where you're going and why you're going there and why that's important to you as well. And that seems to me to relate to the purpose aspect of things. And then, you know, you want the significance aspect, because, you know, if you're just someone who's going about all these things, you know, on your own, there's no sense of connection with other people around you. There's no sense of, I suppose, how your story is important in the world. Well, you know, in some ways, what's the point of thinking about all this sort of stuff? Like, it's a core need, it seems to me, for our life narratives to intersect with other people's life narratives and to get a sense that, you know, we are connected to other people in certain ways. And so, to me, I suppose if we look at things in these terms, like, we can almost kind of break them down and sort of deconstruct them and reconstruct them in a way that maybe gives us a little bit more of a sense of control. And that's where I think, like, the Michael Steger stuff, looking at, say, coherence, purpose and significance, like, that is such a benefit of looking at things in more granulated terms. If we can maybe get more of a sense of control, then we're not just dealing with almost the behemoth of complexity that is meaning in itself as a topic.
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it, how you identify those elements and how they relate to everyday life. And there is that aspect of psychology where there's a strong tendency to analyse things and break it down to its component parts. And it can be sometimes almost paralysis by analysis. But there is a point to this. And I think it's also reflected when we look at how pursuing meaning in a certain way can address some of the main existential issues that might come up in a therapy. So Yalom, a famous psychotherapist, identified four different kind of existential issues that can come up in therapy. One is related to awareness of and maybe fear of death. One of the challenges is to do with freedom. Like, how will we use our time and our choice, or we could engage in this form of work or live here or live there or be in this relationship or not? There are challenges that just come with freedom and all the choices that we could make. Another challenge is to do with a feeling of isolation or potentially separateness or difference to other people, like, where do I belong, that kind of feeling. And then meaninglessness, of thinking, what's it all for? Like, I might be working hard or doing a lot for other people or in this situation I just don't want to be in. You know, what's the point of everyday life? And certainly whenever people are experiencing suicidality, there's likely to be challenges in terms of isolation or meaninglessness or some challenge like that. So when people are facing those kind of existential anxieties, to consider, what is the sense that someone makes in their life? Where might there be a sense of purpose or aims or direction? And how might that person appreciate some value to their life or mattering in some way, regardless of what they do or don't do or achieve? It helps look at the domain, the range of areas we might consider to address those underlying anxieties.
Well, I think that's so true. And it's interesting as you were describing that there. Like, it strikes me in some ways that these are, I suppose, a modern, like, those four existential challenges, like, they relate in many ways a lot to, for example, modern society. And I suppose, you know, as we're getting all into this and you know, really digging deep into meaning, like, it strikes me that it can be beneficial to almost, you know, look at things quite broadly again and almost get back to maybe a more primitive sense of meaning in some ways. And I heard of a story a little while ago, which I found it so fascinating. And it was talking about, there was a artist whose name's David Cho. And he, I believe, did some art for Facebook. And they, you know, early days of Facebook, they ended up paying him in company shares. And Facebook obviously went really well over the next few years. And so there's this guy who was an artist who basically just had unlimited money for, you know, relatively, and that in many ways led to him having unlimited freedom. Like, super interesting guy. And one of the things that he did with that kind of unlimited freedom was he went and lived with this tribe in Africa called the Hadza tribe. So I believe they're in Tanzania and Kenya and around that area of East Africa, but still living a hunter-gatherer lifestyle in many ways. Like, they'd go off and they'd all hunt together with their bow and arrows, and, you know, they'd catch a baboon and all this sort of stuff. And just a really interesting story of this guy living with this tribe in Africa. And he'd said to these people, you know, oh, how you going? You know, I'm from America. And apparently the first thing that this tribe of people said to him was, oh, is that the place where people jump off buildings?
Mm.
And you're thinking, you know, what a way to almost encapsulate the modern world. But it suggests that there maybe is a little bit more complexity to our modern kind of Western, dare I say, way of living, where, you know, there are all these kind of extra complexities to things. And I believe he asked, David Cho asked the Hadza people, you know, tell me about the happiest day of your life. And this fella had said, you know, there was this one day where we were out in a hunt and I shot the baboon and I was able to bring the baboon back to the tribe. And, you know, we feasted and we danced all night and we had this massive celebration. And, you know, the notion is, yeah, I just felt like 10 feet tall, sort of being able to, you know, be the one who, you know, made the catch for the whole group to be able to feed that night. And it was such an interesting juxtaposition of, you know, there's this way of looking at modern society where, you know, like suicidality in many ways is such a kind of unnatural thing when you look at that in those terms of how someone in East Africa who, you know, hunts and gathers their food, like how they look at our society. That was the first thing that jumped out to them. And to me, that suggests that, well, A, there's a lot more complexity, but also maybe there's an aspect in our society where we really need to think about this sort of stuff, because if we just almost freewheel and go along with kind of the popular culture interpretation of some of these things, well, that leads our society to be, you know, I suppose, described as the one where people jump off buildings. And to me, that was such a stark example of, well, hold on, there is maybe a slight disjointment, I suppose, in the way that we look at meaning and the way that we look at some of these things for, you know, that group of people, the Hadza, to have such a kind of a succinct, almost, you know, slightly kind of negative when you look at it from our perspective, way of looking at our society. But to me, that just, it really stressed the importance of looking at some of this stuff.
Yes, and when you think about it, it can be one of the downsides of modern technology. I know that Jonathan Haidt is one of the people who've written recently about that, about the increased incidence of mental health problems associated with the development of mobile phones and how suicidality, depression, a whole lot of mental health problems in teenagers in particular have increased dramatically, seemingly overlapping with that access to mobile phones. And you think of the number of people, the hours that they might spend on a screen, on a mobile phone, maybe isolated from other family members or in their bedroom or wherever, the amount of time being spent on that and how much of that time is spent in reflecting on things or acting in ways that are deeply meaningful, and how much is the connection that people have with other people through mobile phones or screens the same as actually interacting with each other, like hunting together for a baboon, for example. So that's something to consider as well. There is an extra complication if we spend a lot of time and focus on things that might maybe take us to a more superficial level, comparing where we are with others or inviting comparisons that way, rather than other, dare I say, more what otherwise might be considered more fundamental ways of spending our time.
Well, I suppose just to finish off, Dad, I believe there was a set of questions that you came across that you thought could really help with maybe distilling some of the meaning in our own lives down a little bit more. Do you want to just give us those questions?
Yes, and again, these were questions highlighted by Michael Steger related to spirituality. So it doesn't have to be looking at religion when we talk about spirituality. It's looking at deeper meaning in life. And these are the questions that people tend to also be asking themselves when they are going through something like a midlife or late midlife crisis. Notions of, who am I? What am I on about? How can I be happy? What should I do with my life? How do I know if I'm making the right choices? Where do I belong in this world? And what is the point of striving when I know that life is short? So when we think of those questions, they're the kind of questions that can invite us to consider what we mean by a life lived well. But they can be uncomfortable questions, especially if people are going through a difficult or challenging time. But if we're prepared to hang in there with those questions about identity or connection or purpose, who am I? How can I be happy? What should I do with my life? How do I know if I'm making the right choices? Where do I belong in this world? What's the point of striving when I know that life is short? They invite a deeper kind of reflection. And that's a whole lot of where a greater sense of meaning comes from, if people are open and prepared to reflect in a deep way and being honest with ourselves. And that also adds to not just a greater sense of purpose, but a great sense of authenticity. It leads us to come up with more our own individual answers to those questions. And with that comes a degree of authenticity.
And just to finish off now, you had an observation off air as well about how some of the most meaningful moments in people's lives had a similar element to it. Can you give us a sense of what that is?
Okay, look, I appreciate that question. Just to highlight something which, as you know, is most meaningful to me in terms of experience, and it relates to a kind of transpersonal experience, something which almost seems otherworldly, but there are some experiences that are especially powerful to people, and for me that includes the experience of synchronicity or meaningful coincidences. There have been several times in my life where I've gone through a period of weeks or months where there was an explosion of meaningful coincidences that to me led to a feeling that I've got much more of a sense of what my life is on about, and it strengthened my interest in psychology and working in the mental health area. And I wrote about that in my book, The Positive Psychology of Synchronicity. And I note also with Ken Harris, our interview with him, and referring to the book Second Chances, 23 different contributing authors talking about going through a crisis, potentially a life-threatening crisis, and that turning around. Now, many people, as Ken described, had some experience of synchronicity or meaningful coincidence that helped turn things around, that really added to people's sense of purpose. And now a researcher called Ken Pargament in the positive psychology field, he talks about this in terms of sacred moments. For example, people might encounter a partner, a life partner, in a way that they feel involved such an uncanny, improbable coincidence that they feel it was meant to be. They have a feeling of rightness, and it's enhanced, that feeling of rightness, because of the experience of meaningful coincidence. That would be a particular type of sacred moment where we could say the synchronistic matchmaker was involved. Or, as Pargament described as well, people can have a sense of their work as a calling. Not just work, but it has a meaning beyond that. And sometimes people have a greater sense of their work being a calling if there were uncommon or improbable opportunities that came up that led people to have that opportunity or work in that area or be able to further what they were doing in some way. So just mention that because I think that there's a whole dimension of transpersonal experience, another form of spiritual experience, which is really de-emphasized in psychology and mental health generally because it's hard to research. You can't do double-blind trials on it. You can't just click your fingers and muster it up or simulate it in a laboratory. I find as a therapist, not just personal experience, but as a therapist, I've heard many people's stories of different experiences they've had, including a feeling of encountering the spirit of a deceased loved one, for example. That can be a profoundly meaningful experience that I've known situations where it's just resolved the person's grief, fully resolved their grief. They now feel they still have an ongoing relationship with that person, but in a different form. So as a grief therapist, Niemeyer puts it, the bonds are not broken, but transformed. So just to acknowledge, there are circumstances where people might have epiphanies or profound experiences that have a transpersonal quality that I think can turbocharge change, including improvements in mental health, resolution of grief, depression, trauma reactions, which have this transpersonal element. So just to acknowledge that.
Well, thanks for chatting with me about all this today, Dad. It's and over the last few episodes as well, like, it's been a great topic to get into meaning, because as we've, you know, spoken about today, like, something that was maybe de-emphasized in psychology for a little while, but to me it's just such an omnipresent aspect of life. And I suppose that there's just one almost final point that I want to make with it. And that's that, you know, I was reading some of this stuff and doing a bit of research, and you know, I almost felt like the Wile E. Coyote with kind of stars spinning around my head in some ways. Like, it was getting a little bit confusing to almost look at things in these granulated terms. And to me, that's like, notwithstanding everything we've said today about, you know, the benefits that you can get from looking at things a little bit more granulated. But at the same time, like, to me, like, meaning and almost the aspect of meaning in our lives is more of an art than a science, if that makes sense. Like, it's something that's so kind of personal and individual, and we're all going to resonate with completely different things. So I think there's an aspect to it of, you know, all we can really do is kind of arm ourselves with as many tools as possible and, you know, go out there and sort of, you know, make our own way with some of this sort of stuff. Because although it's super helpful to look at like the Stegger stuff and look at, you know, everything that we've looked at over the past little while, there's going to be some things that people go, oh, you know, why are we talking about, you know, dudes who lived in a barrel 2,000 years ago? Or why are we talking about, you know, things that aren't as relevant to me now? But I suppose the main thing with meaning sort of stuff is that, well, it's not as if there's not going to be anything out there at all that's relevant to you, or, you know, there's no kind of ways of looking at it or different tools that we can kind of pick up for ourselves that are going to be good. It's just a matter of finding the ones that work best for us. So, yeah, thanks for chatting with me about all this today, Dad, and, yeah, look forward to the next one.
Yes, Ryan, my final reflection with this, I suppose, to look to simplify it, is it comes down to what matters to us. So basically spending some of that active time, putting a little bit of reflection and effort into spending time doing things that matter most to us, and looking to spend time with people that matter most to us. A lot of it comes down to that. And look forward to next time, Rowan.